You ready to go, Marty?
We'll start it. Yeah, we're just, so we might need a little time. We need to start and stop because, we're getting another recording device that should be a little easier than this for the next board meeting.
Okay.
So we might need just a hair of a time just to turn it on and off for, so it doesn't look like we're editing them in the recordings.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Very good.
Missing 18 minutes.
So do we have any public input tonight? Seeing none.
I got an email from the public. Are we going to talk about that later?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, right?
Yep.
Probably the same one I got.
Yeah.
Okay. So item 2, executive session. Do we need to go into executive session tonight?
We do tonight, yeah.
We have a motion.
The move is the executive session.
That was Tim made the motion. Is there
second.
A second? Is Karen? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye, that was unanimous. We are now going into executive session. We're going to turn off that one.
Is this personnel or is it property acquisition?
It's personnel related. Okay, we're back in open session.
And with that, I'd like to make a motion for Scott Morrison's merit increase to be 5% this year.
Is there a second?
Second.
Oh.
Second.
Yeah. Tim? Me. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That was unanimous. item 4. Consent agenda. Any questions? Is there a motion to approve it?
I make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Karen and Bob, we can be Bob that way. All those in favor?
Aye.
So that was unanimous. Item 5. We have the department updates in our packets. Did anybody, were there any questions you'd like to go over?
I wanted to know how the meeting went yesterday.
It went really well. Doug and I presented to the council on a work session yesterday, presented on the essentially Mountain Regional's water losses, where we're past, present, and future, essentially. Where we started, where we're at today. Roger Armstrong had asked for the meeting because he had been doing some reading on essentially the energy footprint of water losses, that it's not just about losing the water, but there's an energy footprint to that as well. So we talked about that, and we talked about some of the improvements that we hope to be able to make in the future. You know, the theme that we tried to present was that the national average, to our knowledge, is in the range of 30%, and we're just below 15% last year. You know, so the story that we attempted to share is that, you know, we believe we're doing a good job. We're implementing some approaches that are different than what others are doing that are helping, and we hope to continue to reduce those losses in the future. It was really well received. We had some good questions from Roger and from the council. Glenn Wright had some great feedback on our new meters. He has a similar meter at his house. He's in the Park City District, and he just talked about how valuable they are to drive down consumption just through knowledge and understanding of how much water you're using. So we were pleased. We thought it went really well. You know,
is Park City's percentage of loss similar to ours, or I mean, you know, they kind of, I've just been listening to the stories on the radio, and they kind of alluded that Park City maybe was doing a better job.
I don't think they're doing a better job. I don't know that for sure, though. I don't know what their exact percentage is. I know that they hired somebody last summer to focus on just that because I think they had some fairly significant losses that they were trying to track down. And I know that they did find at least one large leak that had been running for a long time up in the Deer Valley area. Wow. But I'm not sure what their percentage is.
Yeah, yeah. So, I was just curious because I've been following it.
So
yeah.
Loss calculation. Is it nothing more than just water in, water out?
It is, that's correct.
So it could be a line break. It could be, you know, any kind of loss. What about evaporation?
So, evaporation, yes, like off the pond, mm-hmm. right? What I help to educate the council on is that when we say water loss, everybody immediately thinks leak. But what it is unaccounted for water.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just between what you're pumping in from all the wells and the reservoir and what's showing up on the meter after a period.
Exactly. So, you know, flushing practices, whether it's from us for water quality purposes, we measure how much water we're releasing through those activities, and we account for that. But if there's a new subdivision put in, let's say, and the contractor's flushing the debris out of the line, and then they're putting high levels of chlorine in the line to disinfect it, then they need to flush all of that out. Historically, that has not been tracked. So any of these activities that aren't tracked will present themselves as losses.
I'm going to guess that they make a very small percentage of the loss.
Water line breaks?
Yeah.
We're reporting, like I said, 15%, and I would bet water line breaks themselves, I would agree with you, Tim, are a very small percentage. It's the systemic losses that are the biggest bulk of
it. Yeah, I mean, it's got to be. You see those, you get them fixed.
Exactly.
You stop the water, whatever.
Yep.
It's the ones you don't see
yep.
going on. You know. 365.
Yep. It's, you know, one of the points I made to council was that we've got a couple hundred miles of pipe in the ground and tens of thousands of connections. Yeah. Not just services, right? We've got about 4,000 services. But at every bend, there's a fitting, right? There's connections everywhere, right? So it's the systemic losses that are... You'll never get them all. You know, you're always going to suffer from some percentage of systemic loss.
Okay.
One of the things I had asked Scott was, at what point do we hit the point of diminishing return? So you can spend a lot of money trying to get that last gallon of water, you know, to show up somewhere.
Right. Because of how much the water costs.
it does, but yeah. I mean, it will... sort of depend on that.
And we thought about that and talked about it internally, Bob. What's interesting is you can think about it a number of different ways. You ask, what's the processing cost of the water? Well, the processing cost is not very much. It's, you know, it was 22% for the energy. If you throw some chemicals in for the plant, some processing costs at the plant, maybe you're at 30 cents. And then there's all these different layers, right? You could say, well, if we include water rights, it's a dollar. I think that one of the most expensive pieces is if you consider what does it cost to develop the source that you're realizing, it's a lot more than that. So it's all in how you kind of look at that, right?
Yeah. Scott, on the community water, there's these reports about it. It sounds like there's a delay coming from Vail.
Mm-hmm.
But are those delays, are they putting us at any kind of risk for...
I wouldn't call it a risk. One of the effects of that is that Lisa has a half year's worth of revenue built into our budget for this year coming from those customers. So if we don't absorb those customers and realize that revenue, that'll lead to a budget amendment. At some point,
we were pretty conservative, though, on how many we thought we were going to...
We had a year's worth in, and at the last minute, I cut it in half. So it's about $250,000.
That's an interesting factor in there. You didn't have it in your memo about mm-hmm. why we should deal. I mean, right there is a reason why we should deal right there.
We're going to have we've got an item on the agenda, I think, for January water update.
On the energy and resource the GIS and asset management, is that something that's ongoing, or have we just started that out?
So we've been using Esri's GIS products for years. We got behind on the updates on the GIS software, so Doug spent all last week just focused on getting us back up to speed. Asset management, we have a program in-house that we've yet to implement.
Can I ask about the phrasing of the
UX,
right?
Yeah.
I had a question. In Lisa's update, that we're 21% ahead of last year.
We're 21% ahead of our four-year average.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yep.
That seems large.
Significant.
Is there one driver on that?
I think it continues to be the hot, dry summers.
It's the whole year.
It's the whole year.
Sorry,
oh,
I thought
right.
It was year-to-date. Four-year.
Yeah, that was all of 2018, I think. We ended up at 21.
All right, that makes sense.
Do you think any of it's the new meters that we're capturing more of it?
We were going to talk about that. No. We think we're seeing a little bit of that. We had a little bit of an adjustment that happened in December that skewed the December number down a little bit more. But I just looked at January's consumption, and we're down again in January from last year. We're kind of on for last year, but over a four-year average, we're down 9%. So that would indicate that, yes, the meters that we're putting in we're starting to see the benefits from that.
Yeah.
It also, did more, were there more people coming transient in and
out? That's what I was going to ask. It's really hard to have that impact.
Well, no, the sewer district does the flush index, and that's pretty consistent with what he said, too. He thought it was 10% down.
Yeah.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
That's not
a lot.
Who knew listening to Randy Barton in the afternoon was chaos?
I can't catch him in the afternoon. I try to hear nothing.
I'm always in the car with kids picking up from school and stuff, so.
Okay, I think that's pretty good on the.
I have one more question. Marty, on the hazard assessments with the meters,
yes.
The backflows, what's a hazard assessment entail?
A hazard assessment is when Stacy Blomquist, which you'll hear a little bit more about tonight, she will go out and assess, and typically it's when there's a concern with a commercial application or, for example, Quarry Mountain Ranch, where they use the ponds for their irrigation, but they use our water for culinary. So they've got two systems, and you just want to make sure that there's no communication between the two. The ones that she did this last month were actually up in the, I believe they were in the Stagecoach area that we could get to still, because they don't plow the roads. But it was a woman who had her well hooked up, going through her meter, and she had the well pump was stuck on. And so it looked like she had a leak, and it wasn't on our system, and it's like, wait a minute, your meter should never touch your well. So that's the hazard assessment that she was able to, to determine. We have a check valve on the meter setter, so that couldn't have theoretically gone back into our system, but that should never happen. And so she does periodic checks of a certain percentage of all of the, the backflow assemblies each year, just to make sure someone hasn't made a rookie change and not realized that they could contaminate their family or us. So
it's kind of like a consulting service that we provide.
Right, and we do it for our own benefit,
yep.
I think, yeah. And then the customer can be in, it's a cease and desist kind of thing.
Okay.
Hey, Marty, on the service orders.
Yes.
So, what's a normal level of open service order?
A lot of times you'll generate service orders, and then they either may, the guys will typically we track. They usually are tracking pretty safely. You issue one, and they're completed in a timely manner. And typically within a day or two, there are some that get canceled, and so you'll always have that sense. And typically with construction, like a contractor thinks he's ready and then he isn't, and then he doesn't want to pay for a visit by us, because we will charge you know, a guy has to drive all the way up to the colony and then oh, geez, I thought I'd be ready, but I'm not. Or mm-hmm. So, but there's a fair amount. There's a whole lot more in the summer when people are using their irrigation water than in the winter. The winter are usually serious problems, like freezing or, you know,
It felt like from the way it was phrased that we have a backlog building of service.
Oh, no. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't intend that at all. Yeah.
And one thing, Marty, I talked to Anna today because I have the same question. What's the average? How many should we expect a month? And I said, why don't we just start tracking how many we have a month and we build, you know, a couple of years worth. We'll understand what's normal. Does it fluctuate at different times of the year? And it sounds like she had already been doing that. Mm-hmm.
That's where I get my numbers from.
Yeah, so. She was going to go back and try to populate that. Okay. So it might
be
helpful.
Well, and also, a lot of service orders are generated and not completed that are the meter changeouts for various areas. So we made all the work orders to go to Spring Creek and to Blackhawk. And then part of Sun Peak. So
they might sit there until the weather's better.
They may sit there until next summer. They may sit there until the summer after. But at least they're made and they're ready to go. Yep. So
the other thing I was curious about, so on the people who are using Ion Water, mm-hmm. are they more proactively reporting leaks? Can you tell from your data? I couldn't tell from looking at it.
I don't know that they're more proactive. We try to make them proactive because we want them to fix their leak. Usually we're contacting them. And then for them to apply for a leak adjustment, we require them to have a leak alert set up that's within the range that they should have, between 1 and 3 gallons per hour. And we won't give them a leak adjustment until they actually do that because then you're in the whole pattern again, losing a bunch of water, nobody pays attention. And a lot of the people that do have leaks don't even have the service set up, haven't even logged on ever.
They have a new meter, but they haven't accessed
Ion Water, right. Yeah. So we try to educate them and try to get them to sign up and then try to track their usage. A lot of them will have very complicated water systems within their homes, like office buildings, you know, big houses with all kinds of boilers and various things. And they can actually do one thing at a time to try to find out, is it on this system? Is it on my water softener? Is it on the boiler? Is it on my driveway where we're, you know, heating it? And they can actually see, because each day as it dumps, you know, it's on this, you know, and so it kind of saves them a little bit of calling maintenance people or plumbers. It's a helpful tool.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, one last thing. Two last things. I'm sorry. I was just curious on the augmentation of East Canyon. What's happening there?
So I guess the most recent update there is I presented at the Weber River Confluence. It's a conference that Weber Basin puts on that was the middle of January. And I presented on what we did last summer and essentially talked about our relationship with the East Canyon Watershed Committee, the stakeholders that we got involved. Mountain Regional turned on a well. Essentially avoided a drying up of that reach at East Canyon Creek between Kimball and Jeremy. With respect to status going forward, what I've been harping on is that we know this is going to happen. There needs to be a management plan for that reach of creek. And for East Canyon Creek in general, Mountain Regional does not want to be in a position of holding our hand out to try to figure out who's going to help pay for the energy costs to put water into the creek. We're happy to do it, but I want to see a plan put together and have funding mechanisms set up beforehand, and that we just know, okay, we're going to run the well from August through September or whatever the period is based on the stream flows, and everything has already been pre-planned and we know how things are being funded. So I believe that the committee, the East Canyon Watershed Committee, is gaining some traction on that. They understand that it needs to be done. They're talking about setting up a nonprofit. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Is that your question, or was it the East Canyon water right thing?
Well, that too.
The state engineer.
That too.
Yeah. It sounded like we've got a nod from the state engineer is going to be approved.
They've been telling us we're close for a year.
Since I've been on the board.
Is it close on their opinion, or is it the way I read it was, it's close on your approved?
My understanding is that it is approved to some extent. We don't know what that extent is. I think Doug's application included 700-ish acre feet, 800 acre feet. Doug's feeling is half. Maybe we'll get half.
Oh, okay.
And they keep saying, you know, we're close to let you know what you're actually getting.
Okay.
So was that what he was referring to in his write-up about the future path with water right changes, or was that a more general?
It's related. Well,
legal statement. That
no, that's a different. That's a different topic. What he was getting at there is, we met with our water right attorney and wanted to inquire about water rights in the East Canyon watershed that go unused for Mountain Regional, and we have so many that we can't use with our sources in the East Canyon watershed. Can we move those to the Rockport diversion? And they're going to investigate that. The reason that they might be able to be moved is because their water right exchanges with Weber Basin. And they would remain as water right exchanges with Weber Basin. The point of diversion would change. It would go to a place where we could actually use the water. One of the questions is, some of those contracts are old contracts and the price per acre foot is fairly low. If we move it, do we have to go to Weber Basin's current rate in that water right exchange? So Jeffrey was going to look into those questions.
Okay. I think that takes us through item five. Number six here is financial management.
Oh, I guess we were going to just get a feel for if everyone likes the department updates in the format they're presented, and if you think that's helpful and beneficial. And
I think it's super helpful.
Okay.
Yep. I mean, it really gives me an idea of everything that's going on in your departments.
Okay. Some of the things we're thinking about as we finish up the strategic plan is, as we identify goals in each department, maybe putting together somewhat of a dashboard so that we could almost have like a, you know, a status update on where we are with those goals that we presented in the strategic plan to add to the language that we currently have. But
fewer acronyms,
look
at. I always feel like I'm reading through it. I'm like, what's CC? And then I have to go back and I'm like, I figure it out. But
typical procedure is if you're using an acronym in a document, the first time you spell it out, no matter what, you assume there's some reader that doesn't know the acronym. Yeah. So that would be really helpful if we did that moving forward.
We can do that.
I tend to not read the list of what's going to be forecasted for next month. And I don't compare that against what they did this month. So if you're having them put that in there because you want to see it for just making sure they have a plan, that's fine. But I tend to not read it. I don't know about the rest of you.
I've been reading it.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. I think it helps people plan, too. And then you look back and you say, did I do this? I like that.
Yeah. We'll keep doing it.
But I will admit to not reading last month's to do and compare to what I
did. And I would think that list should be abbreviated. It should be just bullet points, not extensive details, whereas current month, I appreciate all those details.
Okay, perfect.
All right,
good feedback. Thanks.
Just we'll go over the preliminary December 2018 financial report. We leave December open a little bit longer just to make sure we're capturing all the 2018 expenses, so we kind of leave that open until the end of January. We will have the contribution, the net transfers on that first page in the district change in net position. Sorry. It's the one, the one with the Mountain Regional logo.
Yeah.
The big one. No, sorry, the big one.
Number six, there you go.
we're just wrapping up getting all of the contributions from developers and that we accepted this year that would go in that net transfers line item. It looks like we accepted the Colony had quite a bit of infrastructure that we accepted this year, so that'll be coming on. And then Silver Creek Village has some more infrastructure. So we're looking at about $1.5 to $2 million, I think, in net assets that we're taking on. So that will increase that net transfers line. The other thing we wait on in December are pension entries. We're waiting for the Utah Retirement System to get us the pension entries. So I anticipate that kind of mid-end of February, and then we can incorporate that in the financial statements. We are also just kind of leaving that open to make sure we've got all the invoices for the capitalization of the Silver Creek tank and pump station. So I didn't have a formal capital projects roll forward in here, but we will have that once that's completed.
When will the state be ready with their pension money?
Usually mid to end of February is when we get those numbers.
So are we anticipating a hit because the market was way off in December?
We're on a year lag. So remember, last year we were anticipating a benefit, but we actually took more pension expense. So this year we anticipate there to be a benefit. So our pension expense should go down. So, and then field work for the audit will start in mid March, and we've engaged the same firm that we used last year. That was our first year with them. So.
Same people, same partner on the audit, Osborne, Robbins, and
Dana will be the audit partner. She may have a staff that helps her, but she runs most of the audit. Our change in net position so far, we're at $4.25 million, which is just over $2 million better than we had projected, and that largely is from our higher water sales. We're almost close to $1 million over what we budgeted, and higher impact fees of $643,000. Our expenses were also about $500,000 lower than we anticipated, but about $500,000 higher than last year. We anticipated the increase due to power costs, Weber Basin and lease fees. Those are all kind of why we're higher than last year, but we still ended up a little bit lower than we had anticipated. oh, sorry, go back, Chris. Up one more. Yeah. So here's total retail water sales. Like I said, we're just about $1 million over. We've kind of seen that trend as the hot, dry summer that we had. Park City Wheeling. That's largely the $60,000 increase is largely due to them taking more water this year, so that variable component was increased. And we anticipate that to continue. They took quite a bit of water in January, so we'll likely see that continue. And because the power did go up this year, their variable rate has been at 23 cents. It jumped 3 cents, so now they'll be paying 26 cents. So that'll be a little bit higher and kind of what we anticipated for budget. For 2019.
Well, listen, the January bills, did they reflect the rate increase?
Yes. And they just went out last week? Beginning of this week?
Correct.
Yeah.
Or beginning
of last week. Right.
Oh, it's today's
this
the
7th,
right? So
it was
the beginning of this week.
And we're on budget. I mean, we're a little bit over.
Just a little bit over, just the usage was a little bit better. But yeah, everybody's high elevation change, surcharges were changed appropriately. Promontory picked up that little bit in most of their facilities, and then Preserve and Red Hawk and Stagecoach all have their own high elevation different charge.
Reaction anywhere?
I haven't got my bill yet, so I've...
Not yet, but yeah, they're probably just starting to get them or look at them online.
You can get them online, yeah. Yeah, you haven't had any calls, have you?
Yeah, we haven't had any calls at all. Mm-hmm.
It's only a couple bucks. I'm sure you're not going to get any calls.
I know, it's 3%.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to roll it out in January, too, because everybody's water bills are lower.
On the low end, yeah. Yeah, what they're going to do.
Yeah. development-related collections, those are our impact fees and connection fees. Those were up $868,000. We talked about higher impact fees this year. The promontory and stagecoach assessments. So this decrease here that we're showing from budget is largely due to a timing difference. This year we had promontory paid off the final SID bond in 2009, the 2009 bond in December, and we had a stabilization fund of approximately $350 million that we were able to apply to that that final payment, that reduced promontory's payment. So I think when the original budget was done for 2018, that wasn't taken into consideration because that revenue had kind of already been recognized over that life of that bond. So we were a little bit lower there, and then the 2014 bond also had revenue that was recognized in 2017 that was applied to 2018 payments. This variability in the revenue should go away. The 2014 bond is now holding steady with a principal and interest payment of about $387,000 through the life of the bond. So we won't have these fluctuations in revenue like we've seen, like we saw this year. And we did have stagecoach is also included in here that slightly offset that. Sometimes people will prepay the assessments that they have up there. And so we had three customers pay off that assessment at promontory. So, or at stagecoach. So that makes that revenue a little bit fluctuate from what we anticipate. We talked about Park City billing fees. Other revenue, the $192,000, is largely related to higher interest earnings. The PTIF account is now up to close to 3% we're earning, and our cash balances are high. So we're getting a benefit from those balances where they are and higher than we anticipated in the budget. If you go up a little bit, or down, sorry. Expenses. We were under on our expenses in operations, maintenance, and repairs. Largely, just we talked about a little bit. We do have a power of contingency in there in case we needed to run on peak all of the summer. It's about $150,000. So, we did have to go a little bit, but not all the time. So that's some of the savings we saw in the variance to budget. The non-OM&R piece was higher than last year, and that was primarily due to Andy's severance and Melissa's consulting agreement. So that's why you see that $200,000 change from the prior. We were essentially on budget for this year. And depreciation was a little bit low this year because Silver Creek Tank didn't come on. We've got that in the budget for next year coming on, so the depreciation should be on for next year. Non-operating expenses, really nothing there.
How often do those generators out of Lost Canyon run?
Chris Hall?
Once a month.
We've
been down there and actually run the booster station on the generators so they're under load.
Yeah, just to keep them fresh. But they don't run operationally.
Nope.
Only periodically if there's... hasn't been there a couple cases where maybe Weber Basin was doing some maintenance on the intake, or I forget, there were a couple random occurrences where...
Our pond got low, so we would run it during the day.
Yeah, run it during the day, so we didn't have to pay the power penalty on that, but in general, just exercising them.
Yeah,
we take generally a 2-hour stint to 3-hour stint, and it's more for a maintenance thing than it is for true usage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, mine runs once a week. Yeah. Whether you need it to or not.
Cash, go down a little bit. Our cash is in a good position. We're at about $13.59 million. This is an increase of about $1.82 over last year, again, due to higher water sales. We're at 335 days reserves compared to 269 last year. Our policy minimum is 120, which we're well above. At 365, when we're a year's worth of reserves, we need to start deciding what we're going to do. But we're at one of our highest cash positions right now. As we move through these winter months, our expenses are going to outweigh our income. So that number will drop until we hit the summer. So we're in a good position right now. Debt reserves held by the district decreased about 20%, $842,000, and that was due to the planned use of promontory prepaid assessments and stabilization fund to pay the 2018 bond, make the 2018 bond payments. That's paid off. Only the SAA 2014 assessment remains in place. Debt reserves held by the trustee decreased significantly. We make all of our bond payments in the middle of December, so that's why that went down $2.2 million. That balance of 688 meets the required levels that our bond trustees, IANs, requires of us right now. Regionalization reserve increased almost 400,000. That's just putting a third of each one of the quarterly payments into that account. We'll continue to do that this year on the summer water sales. Other restricted cash increased over the past year, and that's primarily due to treatment plant deposits that we made this year. We do have, we kind of use that as a reserve fund to build up cash in there, because the nature of when those expenses come in, it varies significantly. So, for example, we have carbon out right now that's getting cleaned, and so it's due to come back, so we'll have $80,000 come out of that fund, and then you just signed the PO for the membranes, which is another 144. So that fund has been building up, and now we're seeing those expenses come through. We'll see those expenses come through. Customer deposits is down a little bit. We've kind of been seeing that trend. We've had fewer impact fees, or fewer number of impact fees. Customer deposits are coming down accordingly. Customer growth, go down a little bit more. Here's... So we had 104 new connections for 2018. We have a four-year average of 127. So like I mentioned, that's coming down a little bit. Impact fees are kind of in line with 2016, lower than 2017. And can you come down a little bit more, Chris? Yeah. The per connection, like you can see, is higher, but the amount is lower, so larger homes that we're seeing come in. And Promontory ended up with 40 assessments. Their four-year average is 35, so they're right where they kind of have been. On the next page, on usage or water consumption, this is where we saw a little bit of a, we had a correction in December for the sports park meter was read incorrectly. So we had an adjustment there that came through in December, so that number's a little bit artificially low. By 9 acre feet, that was that adjustment. But overall, in the different classes, large residential, residential townhome, we did see a little bit of a decrease. So, usage was down. Like I said, it looks like we're a little bit on par for January, but again, down from our four-year average. Scroll down a little bit, Chris. For year-to-date, this is year-to-date 2018, there's a 21.2% that we're up for all of 2018 as compared to the four-year average. So that's pretty significant. It'll be interesting to see where we end up this year. Park City was up 40%. We continue to see that. I think that trend increased. We think it will definitely be over 2,000 acre feet, maybe closer to 25 this year. Summit Water took their allotted 800 this year.
Plus one.
So we get to invoice them for $1,900 for their plus one. So we ended up, and they were up 30% from their four-year average, but that's just based on contracted amounts. So total, we did 5,747 acre feet this year.
So the total was 5,700 acre feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's total, it's raw water.
Yes.
Yeah. Raw water.
Potable water.
Yeah.
That's all I had. I'll get you an update of the capital budget when we finish capitalizing those projects and get the developer contributions in.
Very nice. Is there any questions or anything else there for item six?
Just the only other thing we talked about was just putting up the timeline. Lisa updated the timeline that we presented last month. There's a couple of minor tweaks and some additions.
And Scott will go into more detail on this. I just thought we'd kind of throw it up and give an initial overview. We'll kind of go through the capital improvement plan timeline tonight. The March meeting will be our annual meeting where we elect officers for each one of the open positions. Well, I guess you say the committees, the different committees, sorry. Dave also does his board training, and we will have a final strategic plan for you to review, as well as a capital improvement kind of roadmap and overview of the methodology we'll be using to start that project. In March, we will have personnel and rules and regs policy review to go through. The May meeting will be the audit presentation. June, we plan on looking, June 13th, we plan on looking at a capital improvement plan. That's going to be in a form where we would need a recommendation from you at that time to the council, at which time then we can go meet with the council for a work session, get their input, and then hopefully get some kind of approval on that capital improvement plan. We have to hold a public hearing, and the council actually formally adopts that. And then we would move into the impact fee analysis process. So it's a long process, and Scott's going to go over all that in more detail. But that's where we are, if anybody has
any
questions.
That's for June. That's an important
one. Yeah, that's not until June.
Yeah. But that's when we're going to need...
We're going to need everybody.
We're going to need... to have something we can take to the council, move something up.
Yeah, the target is that we will present in a work session to the council in the beginning of July with hopes that we can quickly notice thereafter in mid-July have it approved by the council.
So that's the meeting I have a conflict on.
June.
Okay.
The 13th?
Yeah.
I think I do too as well. Yeah.
Do we have the ability to change it still at this point?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Good.
Do we want to look at that now, or do you want to get back to us with definite?
I need another calendar. It's not the one on this phone.
Okay. Why don't you look into it, Ian, and get back to us, and we'll look at our calendars and.
Great. And I was just going to ask, too, we had two other meetings that we were wondering if we could change dates to kind of fit in with UEA, and then also the November meeting with some other meetings that we had going. So if I can just give you those two dates to look at, too, and we can talk about next month?
Yep.
Does that work?
Yep.
So the one we were tentatively thinking we'd like to change was the October meeting to the 24th of October. And then also November meeting to the 21st of November. And I actually have them in blue, so you can kind of put a little schedule here if you'd like to take this home and kind of just have our schedule.
Yeah.
Okay, you can just pass those around. Yeah.
In June, the 20th would work better, the 13th. On the 13th, I can't even call it.
So it sounds like June needs to move. June 20th?
Yep.
Yeah, I can't call them in June.
I think.
Okay. So October, we're moving to the 24th. It's my anniversary that one day.
Yeah.
It works. I think I might have been here on my anniversary last year.
Aww.
Well, then I was here on your anniversary too.
So we'll look at June 20th and see how that looks for us internally.
Thank you.
Any other comments on dates at the moment?
Okay, that's great. I think that takes us through six. Item seven, strategic and capital improvement plan update.
Yeah, so we held all-day meetings on Wednesday. Doug and I invited each department to come in and share with us their outlook or goals, essentially, for the next few years, some areas that they wanted to improve, which was actually really productive. Everybody was engaged and excited, and we were really happy with how that went. So Doug and I, over the next 2 weeks, will be folding those goals in as red lines into his current draft, and then we will, you know, spend some time on trying to put a summary together to try to tie these goals and these self-assessments and see how much consistency we have, and really try to close up this effort, get it done, and then we will provide a copy, a final draft to you at the next meeting.
Will that be draft number 7?
It will be draft number 6, I believe. Oh. Yeah.
I thought he already had done draft number 6.
I think we've removed about 50 pages, so I think we're starting to get down to a document that's a little more functional. On the capital improvement plan process, that's what Chris has up on the screen now. Lisa and I mapped this out a couple weeks ago to kick this process off. This is all mapped based on our need to understand what these impact fees will be for the budgeting process. So we stepped back from our fall budget activities to put this schedule together. So the two public notices on the top have already been released. They are noticed currently. Over the month of February, we're going to be doing some internal reviews on the previous document and evaluating how the methodology and how the feel of that document, you know, feels to us as a staff. I can say that the impact fee approach, where we charge the impact fee based on square footage of homes, that seems to be working very well. There was a lot of work put into coming up with that approach back in 2013, so I expect that we'll stick with that. In March, as Lisa talked about, we'll provide just a brief overview of what that methodology is and kind of the roadmap of the previous document, get any feedback from you, and then we'll get to work on creating our updated version of that. That'll be presented to you in June, as we just discussed. It'll go to the council in a work session in July for the hopeful adoption by the council in mid-July. Then Zions Bank will need to certify and perform their impact fee analysis. And then the final hurdle will be a public hearing that you, the Administrative Control Board, will hold here in October to adopt the updated fees.
Okay. Any questions on 7? Okay, item 8. To consider approving a surplus water agreement.
Yeah, so I'll give a little overview. Has everybody had a chance to read what I wrote there?
Yes.
Not all.
But I do have questions.
Okay, yeah, and I've had a chance to stew on it a bit for another week, so the quick overview is that surplus water agreements are typically agreements for out-of-district customers. It essentially says that the out-of-district customers are a second priority customer, that the water is only available while we have the surplus. We have the ability to terminate that, you know, typically with, say, a 30-day notice or something to that effect. through working with TCFC in Vail, the request, essentially, TCFC's come back and said, for this to work, these lodges would have to be, their level of service would have to be the same as an in-district customer, that it could not be an interruptible service any more so than a normal customer service. The term of the agreement, they're pushing back on any term that's less than 20 years. With the only opportunity for termination for Mountain Regional would be is if they did not pay their bill, non-payment. And so where that leaves us, I think, is there's two probable approaches, I'll say. One is that they annex into the district. These two lodges annex into the district. We continue to not, you know, Dave and I have talked, and in the annexation documents, we would ensure that we don't own any of the infrastructure on the mountain, much the same as how this contract is written. Really, there'd be very little difference other than they're annexed in. By annexing in, they would be charged a commercial rate per our fee structure. They'd be our customer in perpetuity. If they ever wanted to go to another provider, they would pay a change in service provider fee. But Mountain Regional couldn't call them up one day and say, yeah, we're not going to provide you water anymore. You know, we're not at liberty to do that with our customers. So that's the annexation path. The contract path would be treating them as an in-district customer as if they were annexed, charging them an out-of-district rate, which is a higher rate, for a term of 20 years. And, you know, my question to Dave, that he and I chatted a bit before the meeting, but I'll ask him again. Over the last week, where I've landed is that I feel it's just a question of risk, which does the contract approach present more risk or more potential liability to the district than the annexation approach? And if the answer is no, then are we just quite simply choosing between an annexed customer at a lower rate versus a non-annexed customer at a higher rate? If both the contract and the annexation, the annexed customers, both have to abide by our rules and regulations. So does the contract present any more risk to the district?
Not the way that we've structured the deal.
And by annexing, do they get their water at some fixed amount, or do they got to pay the cost of getting it uphill? Also, I mean, what's the elevation difference between where that water's coming from and where they want it delivered?
So they own the pumps. They own the pumps. They own all of that. Essentially, we deliver the water adjacent to the community water tank. It's sourced by the community water wells that are there. We have the ability to provide backup service if there's an issue with those wells.
So I've been familiar with a surplus water agreement before. Like Salt Lake City has lots of them,
yeah.
And they. So why would they do that? Why would they work under a contract rather than just annex somebody in?
Salt Lake?
Yeah.
It depends if it's Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
If they're outside the boundaries of the municipality,
yep.
That's the only way they can do it under the Utah Constitution.
Okay. It's law.
Yeah. We're not bound by those same rules.
It'll be a 3-year term, and it sort of lets them say, okay, well, what are our other priorities here? Has anything changed? Do we still like our deal here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the odds of us interrupting the service down at the point where their pump goes in? I mean, if it's the interruption that we're concerned about, they're more likely to be interrupting their service than we are.
Yeah. My concern, Tim, was a 20-year term with a customer that, you know, is known to be challenging. If that contract had presented risks or holes or an opportunity to have a problem. And
a long time.
For a long time. And if the answer is no, then if there's no more risk to the contract, then we don't need to be concerned about the term.
Is there a perception risk that they're getting special treatment that can be picked up on by other entities? And it seems like they're telling us what they're going to get.
To some extent, that's true, but we are also, there's some elements in the contract that I think are hugely beneficial to us, meaning we don't own any of that infrastructure. They pay for their meter up front. They pay for all replacements of their meter. They pay a higher usage rate. They pay the infrastructure fee for the community water system, based on the number of ERCs they have.
That's pretty typical because they're not a customer, right? We don't provide.
Yeah, they're not annexed in. And I think
it's their infrastructure.
I mean, the one thing we negotiated with them that makes it so that they're not really getting preferential treatment is that they have agreed that they're going to abide by our rules and regulations. So they're not going to get anything more than what our customers are currently getting. But they will be paying more for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, Joe Blow comes up, you know, 50 feet down the road and says, I'll take that same deal. We'd probably take it.
They don't have the same leverage, though, do they?
Well, I think to Bob's point that it's a pretty good deal for us.
Yeah. And we get the higher rate, we, you know, we essentially dump them at a wholesale location, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They still have the 20-year term.
And well, that's what's made me feel uncomfortable as well. But I'm not advocating for them, but the more I think about it, an Annex customer is in
it.
So we got a customer for 20 years at a higher rate or a customer forever at a lower rate. Why does the term matter? That's where I'm starting to land in my head.
But this is Vail themselves or is TPFC?
Well, it's going to be through TCFC, but under their 350-year lease with Vail, they provide the water.
For this. 3.5 centuries?
Yeah. All in 50-year increments. It's like a 50-year lease with like six automatic renewal.
They're not going to run into the Park City problem.
You know, we need to commit.
I guess we'll see in 350 years.
It's older than the country.
20 years old.
That'll be 5 lives from now, right?
Exactly. So essentially, the way they've structured it, they've written the agreement so that they're essentially an annex customer at a higher rate.
And Scott, again, what are you recommending?
Well, we have to own the water rights and that kind of stuff, right? To supply the water. So, but they get exempted from us needing to worry about water rights and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They just got to get it up the hill.
But yeah. It seems like they don't even take probably water in the summer, so
it's not
the interruptible
it's only winter time.
Issue. I mean, you think you could see that in July or August if we had a drought, but you know, it's not like there's a shortage of water in January or February when they're using it. No. So.
And I'll close with a couple of comments, and then I'll provide you my recommendation. One comment is that we talked about, is there any way that they could expand their usage of water? Well, the way the agreement's written, it's specific to these two lodges. So the only way they could do that is if they upsize the lodges. Well, that's not going to have a huge impact on us. And then, Tim, you asked earlier, or mentioned that I could have alluded to the budget issue, right?
Right.
That there's a couple of things.
If we close a deal with them on community water, then we're putting, it's changing our budget, because we're assuming that we're going to be bringing on 500 customers at some point. So whether they know they got this leverage or not, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
We know whether they do or not.
Yeah.
We're not going to, even if you agree to this deal, we're adding this into the closing. So we're not going to do the deal unless the community water deal comes through.
If we follow the path of annexation, it's going to take a couple few months. That is going to certainly push, it's going to push back Lisa's expectation of bringing those customers on in the middle of the year. That's one effect. At some point we're going to reach a point where we're going to want to move forward, I think, on some additional source development with the well that we've been talking about. That well is being, is part of the Division of Drinking Water loan associated with this project. Now, it's important to understand that that well is to make up for source deficiency of community water. There's 200 gallons a minute of source deficiency. So if the well comes in anything up to 200 gallons a minute, there's no change for us, right? If the well is more productive than that, then that becomes a potential benefit for Mountain Regional. That benefit wouldn't be realized until we did the project.
So how much water would we deliver in acre feet?
To them?
Through this agreement.
Three and a little, it's about a few. Little over a million gallons a year.
Yeah.
3 acre feet, and we just did 5,700?
Yep.
Last year.
Yep. So. And it's in the winter. So if my feeling is if there's no additional risk in the going, taking the contract route, let's just sign the contract.
Okay, are there any other questions?
And when I say sign the contract, I mean 20 years, no termination unless they don't pay.
Oh, so the 365 day termination is only
out.
On there?
Oh, it we would out. Take out.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they look like a customer.
And they follow all our rules and regulations.
Yeah.
So the only way to kick them out is if they don't pay for 90 days.
Yep.
But so that stays in.
Yes.
Okay.
So is it our recommendation to you to be cut the contract and get the best terms you can? Or do you have to?
We need an exception because this is an out of district contract. So in order to treat them the same as the rest of the customers that are within Mountain Regional, you need to grant an exception for them.
Is the council going to have any issue with that?
We're granting, but they're not customers. They're.
But it's in our rules and regs. So as we have written here, in accordance with the exception to the rules and regulations granted by the Mountain Regional Administrative Control Board, the property shall receive the same level of service afforded to customers residing within the Mountain Regional Service Area.
Where is that from?
This is in the contract.
But it's taken from your rules and regs. Yeah.
Our rules and regs say if it's an out-of-district customer, they're a second priority customer.
And this is
and we're saying that we need an exception from the board
to
the rules and regs to afford them the same level of service as an in-district customer.
Right, so it sort of sets the precedent for 20 years, and then the exception, does it kind of negate our ability to have other surplus water agreements?
No.
Where they're,
this is
just a precedent.
This is the reason why this is an exception, so it doesn't set a precedent, so that anyone who wants a surplus water contract that wants the same terms as Vail and TCFC are wanting are going to have to petition the board to have an exception and to describe why they should get the exception.
Why should they?
Because of, yeah. Why should they get the exception? If we want, two reasons. One is, if they don't, it'll cause further delays to the annexation process and start to impact Mountain Regional's budget. And the second reason is that if it's essentially the same terms as an annex customer, then non-regional will get more revenue from this customer than they otherwise would.
But from their perspective, they're a business. They can't operate a lodge under the potential of their water being turned off.
Exactly. That's their pushback.
They can't accept those terms. So I think if we look at it from their perspective, it's pretty much the contract void unless something goes in that they can run their business and guarantee water to their customers.
Well, the other thing is, if we don't do this, then they'll go to Summit Water, probably, right?
I think we'll just have to go through the annexation process. It'll just be, it'll just drag on for another few months, and then they'll be annexed. They'll be our customers. They'll pay the commercial rate in perpetuity. And
Summit Water doesn't want to serve this.
But so if we don't serve it, but who will then?
That's what he's saying, is then if...
Damn. Then they'll apply for annexation.
That's right.
They'll apply for annexation. Yeah. Yeah. So we might as well.
And then they'll be asking you, the board, will you allow us to annex?
All right.
And they wanted to annex before with Community Water, and we told them no because we were concerned about all their infrastructure after the meter.
Yeah.
Okay, I think is that enough? Do we need a motion to approve the exception?
You do.
It's seeking that we have the exemption.
TCFC.
So it's not... Okay, so on our... What we noticed was an approval of a surplus water agreement.
Mm-hmm. And that's approval, and in that agreement... is the exception.
Okay, so what's the motion?
GP.
The motion would be to approve the contract with the exception.
With the exception.
By Bob, is there a second?
I'll second that.
By Ian. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. It's unanimous.
Okay. Moving on.
Number 9.
Then get 10 preferential parking places
assigned. Can we back up and do that?
On lodge parking.
They have a complimentary auto service now up there that works like Uber or something that's in the Canyons area?
Oh, I don't know.
I forget what they call it. I don't know.
I don't scare
my husband's in love with the orange bubble that takes up to that one of the lodges.
Yeah, he'll never want to get out.
Yeah.
Okay, number 9, public service, Marty Gee. Sounds like we have a recognition of an award.
Yes, Stacy Longquist. I don't know if you guys have met Stacy. Stacy's been with our district since May of 2000. We hired her just out of school, and she's been with us ever since. She's served in many areas in the organization. She initially was helping loading checks and doing customer service, and she's also ended up in the field being an operator. She has been recognized as... I just want to say it right, I'm sorry. As an outstanding service by a water operator by Rural Water, which is a really wonderful accomplishment for her. And we're so proud of her, and she's taken on our backflow system, which the state recognizes us as running one of the best in the state. They actually have people call us and see how we are accomplishing all the things we are, being a smaller district but having such a great program. So I don't know, we're really excited. She's going to get this award down at Rural Water Conference in St. George, and those of us that are going, we're going to be supporting her there. And I know she would have liked to be here tonight. She's really busy. She's a mom and has two little boys that she's real busy with. But she's a valuable employee, and I'm so proud to have for being here this long, and did such a fantastic job to be recognized by the state for it. And Rural Water.
How do they nominate somebody? They
accept nominations for these various positions or these various awards, and they go through a committee at Rural Water. And I think Doug is actually on that committee that reviews the applications. And they apparently have people from all over, including state employees, and apparently Doug mentioned to me that one of, you know, the state employees that serve on this committee that does these awards actually stated what a wonderful job she's doing, and they were really, really happy that she was able to be recognized in this way. So, and there's not a lot of women doing this backflow thing, so that's kind of a really neat thing as well. And Stacy was been a certified operator since the first year she worked with us. I think it was within that first year, maybe 6 or 7 months after she started. So we've always felt like education is a huge part of our people being able to do their job the best they can. And so both of the women in our office on my team both have level 3 certifications of wire operator. So that's really a neat thing.
Yeah.
So we're really proud of her.
Yeah.
So I'll take pictures. You guys will have a picture.
Okay.
In your little award. It's awesome.
Are we going to cover costs of going down to the meeting and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so we'll send her down to the conference and get the meeting tickets. And I did offer her a bonus that was within my abilities, just to you know, show our appreciation of her hard work. So.
And they'll probably get a party for her back here too.
Yeah, we want to do a little lunch when we all get back. I know we've all been so crazy busy with all of the things going on. So when we get settled in, we want to do a nice lunch and have. And we'll invite you guys.
Please, yeah, that sounds nice. Let us know.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Okay, that's very nice, Marie. Item 10, the update on the legal from Dave Thomas.
Let's see, I've got. Franchise agreement.
Is that where we have to pay $5,000 to the county?
Yeah. Yeah. That was it.
$150 are paying this franchise fee?
Well, we had a meeting with all the water entities about franchise agreements. And with the draft franchise, it seemed to revolve around two things. With two of the companies, Gorgoza Mutual and Summit Water. One, they didn't want to pay a franchise fee. And the second issue appeared to be that they were in opposition to the minimum consumer protection provisions. The consumer protection provisions were you have to provide an emergency phone number for your customers to call in case there is an emergency in the system. Secondly, you have to provide clear invoices that people can understand. You also have to make contact on a service call within 30 days. You have to respond to a complaint from a customer within 30 days. And you need to give 30 days notice to your rate payers if you're going to increase their rates. So those are fairly modest consumer protections, but they opposed that. When I asked whether they were actually doing those minimums, they all were. They just didn't want the county to put that as a condition. I think my response to them was, because they said, well, those are in our bylaws. And I said, yeah, well, you can change your bylaws. So they're going to give me some red lines within the next couple of weeks. And I'll take whatever those are to the county council. The council only wants, they don't want everybody to have a different kind of franchise agreement. So whatever it is, it's going to be the same for all the water companies. And, you know, we'll see what comes of it. One of the things that did come out of the meeting is that there's another way we can do the franchise. Basically, what the county engineer wants to do is he wants to recover his costs for managing the right-of-way.
Well, that's what taxes are.
And so if he's going to recover the costs, he can do it with a franchise fee, or he can do it by increasing encroachment permit fees. Because right now, encroachment permit fees are $240 that would, for water entities, they would probably double if he wants to recover his costs. So that is, in fact, another option.
And how does an encroachment fee work?
Anytime you want to do anything in the county right-of-way, you need, one, you need a franchise agreement, and then secondly, you need a permit from the county engineer to, you know, to dig or to cut the, you know, the asphalt, whatever it is.
So for like repairs, we'd be paying that on a regular basis.
And aren't those encroachment fees also applied for, say, if you're putting a new driveway in that connected to a county road?
Yep.
So it's not just utility
providers. So we've got $5,000 on this, and we didn't come up with this number. The county came up with the number, and I'm guessing that they figured that in a given year they must spend $50,000 of people's time managing these utilities or whatever that are in the right-of-way, and they decided that we should pick up about 10% of that. What happens if they decide next year that that cost has gone to $500,000?
Well, if you have a franchise agreement, you'll be locked in.
Right.
The
to the rate, or can it change?
Well, I mean, to the franchise fee rate. But I think one of the things that the council is going to look at is, instead of charging a franchise fee, maybe doing something with the encroachment permit fees. So that's a potential.
But agreement would still be required.
Agreement's still going to be required. I mean, part of the problem the county engineer is having is that, you know, he's got franchise agreements from a wide variety of entities, but the one entities that he does not have a franchise with are any of the water companies. And as a result, once you get a trench and somebody's, you know, Comcast cable comes in and they open it up, he's got to be able to, the engineer's got to be able to know what's in that right-of-way and what the buffers between the different things need to be, between, you know, water and sewer, and water and Comcast cable, and he's got to be able to manage that. Right now, he feels hamstrung because he's not being able to manage that appropriately. So the franchise agreements, one of the things that the county engineer is going to ask is if you've got, you know, GPS of where your lines are, he's going to want those because he's going to put together a GIS for all the right-of-ways, and he's going to chart them out so he knows where everything is. One thing that came up in our discussions with Summit Water was the Summit Water operators were talking about problems with neighbors basically planting trees in the right-of-way. You know, we encourage people to landscape, but the trees go down and they're right on their pipe and they break their pipe. And, you know, truly managing the right-of-way, the county engineer would, you know, if something like that happened, the water entity could complain to the engineer, and the engineer would go out and take care of that and remove the tree from the right-of-way. And I think, at least for the water operators, I think the light came on that, I think we really do want a franchise agreement in order for the to empower the county engineer really to manage the right-of-way like he should be managing it. But we'll see. We'll see what happens, because they didn't seem to want to sign a franchise agreement. And as I was talking about when I came in, I just came out of a franchise agreement meeting with Rocky Mountain Power and at least one member of the county council, and it wasn't a pleasant meeting for Rocky Mountain Power. So hopefully, you know, we'll have a franchise agreement that everybody can agree to and sign.
The Rocky Mountain Power one was a renegotiation, right?
Yeah, it's a renegotiation. And it went kind of like this. Future lines, we want, this is the county council member, future lines, we want buried, Rocky Mountain Power. No, we can't do that. Council member, how much do you really want to be in our right-of-way? Rocky Mountain Power, well, you know, we service your constituents. County council member, that's nice. How much do you really want to be in the right-of-way? That's kind of how the discussion went. So,
no more than the Public Utilities Commission is allowing us to be in the public right-of-way.
So,
or whatever they call it here.
Yeah, so it's, it...
So could this franchise agreement require us to provide the GIS locations of the pipes?
It could, but it doesn't.
Because that could be a big cost.
We have the maps on.
I mean, we have it, and so that's easy.
Yeah, I think all the engineers going to do once you have a franchise agreement, you'll probably just get a call from him, and he'll ask, "Do you have whatever you've got?" Because he wants to map it.
My concern, and I've brought this up to Dave once before, and I think Dave amended it slightly, but it's still a concern of mine. Is there's a provision in here titled "Relocation for the County." And what it says is that the county can let us know of either a temporary relocation that's required or a permanent relocation that's required as a result of, let's say, a change in alignment of a road. And it says here that they'll give us 10 days for a temporary and 20 days for a permanent relocation for us to realign at our own expense the road. And 20 days is nowhere near where it needs to be.
Where do you think it needs to be? Because it's well, 20 business days, so it's a month.
The pipe would be in the right-of-way unless the county went and surplus the right-of-way out. So they typically don't surplus out right-of-way if it's got utilities in it.
Typically not. And for underground utilities, there's not... Unless there is a higher priority of something the county wants to put underneath in the ground, I'm not sure what that would be.
Fiber up?
You know, they could have other utilities move. You would still move within the right of way. You would just move your line.
I've seen it. I've done ones where you're like a big overpass comes down. It's going to settle the whole area.
Yeah.
And you got to move everything out and around.
Yeah.
And it takes
What if it's a lot of January and it's
20 inches?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, 10 degrees below zero.
What's UDOTs?
I don't know.
UDOTs is not uncommon when it's establishing prior rights. I mean, if you're going in there and enjoying the right of way, and they're part of enjoying the right of way, is that it comes with an occasional relocation.
Yeah. And I don't have any, my heartburn isn't necessarily with the relocation as it is with the time to pull it off.
You could set a design. You had to put some time on it.
Yeah.
Or approved by drinking water.
I got a couple things in here. You know, what if we, let me find my notes here.
What does it say they can do if you don't move it in 10 days?
If we had to get.
It doesn't say.
If it had to be designed and permitted and bid. And constructed, you know, it's going to take
our bylaws.
Yeah, it's going to take months to do all that.
You can see what UDOT's franchise agreement says. Might be good.
Maybe they have some. Maybe they have some language.
Yeah. You know, and granted, the you know, some of the process can be shortcut through emergency procurement
exercise for me.
What's that?
It just sounds like revenue raising exercise to me. There's not enough tax dollars in the coffer, so they'll figure out some other way to extract money from people.
Okay, I think that's
actually that was the secondary. Secondary was to cover the engineer's costs. The primary was to just get franchise agreements so they could manage what's already in the ground.
They can manage us. They can just call us up and tell us.
True, but
We don't need a franchise agreement.
But you have to be treated like everybody else.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's an equal protection claim that others can say, hey, you know, they didn't have to sign the franchise agreement.
Who's the other outside Gorgoza that took contention?
Summit Water.
What's Park City then?
Park City doesn't use the county's right of way.
Oh,
they just use, although the city of Francis does use the county's right of way for some of their stuff, so they would have to sign a franchise agreement.
How about moving on to community water upgrade?
So we're just going to wait on this until we see what the final agreement looks like. So
because at this point in time, they're going to come back with red lines. And we'll just see what happens.
So I'll just keep you posted. They're not filing suit or anything.
Well, the problem is if they file suit, I would imagine the county council would basically give them a termination notice and tell them to move their infrastructure out of the right of way. So nobody wants that to happen.
In the public interest.
Yeah. Nobody wants that to happen. So it's kind of, it's an interesting dance that everybody's engaged in.
Nice.
The community water, I think we've talked a little bit about the fact that we're still missing some easements. We're missing the same easements. I had a discussion with Vail's attorneys 3 weeks ago where they promised me the next week that they would, they would have that signature. And I'm still waiting.
Do you think by signing this other agreement that maybe that's...
Because what happens now when we sign this agreement, then they'll turn it over to Vail for them to review it.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see how long it takes. I'm still waiting for any red lines for the other interconnect, the one with the canyons, the Grand Summit interconnect. We haven't seen those red lines yet. And I guess Scott can give you an update on the Hidden Cove deal.
Deal, lack thereof. We are trying to construct a valve. Go for it.
One question. Who's supplying water to the lodges right now?
Community water.
Community water.
Operated
by
Summit.
So we can't use that as leverage because we haven't. Nothing's happened yet.
Well, at some point in time, something's going to happen, right?
Yeah, something's going to happen.
We're either going to walk away and say, this deal isn't going to close, and goodbye.
TCFC is not going to close the deal without that agreement.
And at some point in time, we ought to say that. We ought to just say, hey, guys, you want this deal? We're done.
Yeah.
You know, we're not spending any more of our ratepayers' money on all this stuff. You know, sign, get the things in place or we're gone. And then you figure out what you're going to do for what.
It's a good point. It is costing us quite a bit.
Absolutely.
From a man-hour perspective, it's enormous.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's been thousands of hours.
It doesn't seem reasonable.
I mean, I'd have that conversation. And I'd be happy to do it.
The Hidden Creek situation is that we need to construct a valve station above ground. It's a distance.
Where is it?
Hidden Creek is an HOA. It's a condominium complex on the right-hand side of Canyons Resort Drive. It's the last complex on the right before you make the bend below the Grand Summit. There's a valve station we need to install there. It's going to be an above-ground facility because it's got a chlorination station in it. We can't have that below ground. Long story short, we have been unable to get, TCFC has been unable to get an easement for us to put the building in place.
Is this the interconnect?
No.
It's a new piece of infrastructure.
So here's the interconnect
that happened this year.
Yeah, that's by the fire station.
Yeah, and so this is going up Canyons Resort Drive. So initially we had talked about having it placed here. Once we got the property line field located, we realized we were encroaching on the property line and we couldn't put the building here. So we started looking for options. And this is where Scott's
So it's hidden. How obnoxious is it? It's very well hidden. It's very well sited. It's going to be minimally intrusive.
It's going to stand out from the cabaret layout.
it's going to disturb your experience on the
Sorry.
It's
got some control valves in it and chlorination.
So it requires ingress and egress to it.
Yeah, we're planning just to put a couple of parking spots in front of it there, off to the right, accessed off of their driveway. Yeah, so we're not going to impact their parking. So it's going to be hidden in those trees.
Whose property is it?
Ironically, it's TCFC's.
It's TCFC's property, but they have an easement.
A 350-year lease.
They've given an easement to Hidden Creek.
Yes,
for open space.
The property line goes something like it's out into the pond and then comes back, and TCFC owns this piece in the middle. But irregardless, there would be pipelines and stuff that would have to cross the Hidden Creek parcel to get to this building, as well as a soft surface parking that we were talking about right there.
The waterline stubs that we have to get to are on the east and west side, both of those transformers that you can see in the image there.
Over there.
So we need easements from both.
Correct.
Parties.
And TCFC has already drawn up the easement to give to us on their property, but they can't grant it because there's been talk on whether or not they can grant the easement because they have another easement on that parcel for open space.
With Hidden Creek.
So the most recent update I got this afternoon was from an attorney with TCFC, and they are considering granting us the easement regardless on their parcel, but we still have to get a temporary construction easement from Hidden Creek to be able to perform the work. So we're still...
Because we have to use part of their parking lot as
staging.
So who decides if we can...
So when do you have to have it in?
Well, we go in as part of all of the system improvements that are planned for community water.
So sometime close.
Not before. It would be, we would close on the annexation, we would close on the loan and get the funds, and we'd go to work.
So it would be good weather.
Yeah.
Won't be disturbing their parking lot during high season.
No. And we have gone to greater lengths than certainly is necessary to work with the HOA of Hidden Creek to help them to understand exactly what we were doing and all the benefits we were providing.
And they're part of the community water thing.
They are. Mm-hmm. They're asking TCFC for compensation for us to locate the facility on that space, and TCFC has said no.
Well, how much compensation do we need?
I don't know.
So TCFC...
I think at least $100,000.
Hidden Creek, the open space easement?
Yes.
So supposedly the homeowners paid for that easement. There was a cost for them to get that easement. That's hard.
Oh, okay.
I think there was some horse trading with some other things, and there's value to that to them.
The homeowners own the open space easement.
Yes.
And so...
They have that property right on that.
I'll just tell them that their easement won't be worth much when it's scorched earth because they have no water.
So it's almost like TCFC can't give us an easement for something they don't really own, though. They already sold it to Hidden Creek.
We aren't going to close the annexation unless we have all the pieces in place that we need to do the job. And we're not going to spend any more time trying to make that happen.
I think we came into a ongoing feud that Hidden Creek is having with TCFC. And so we're kind of collateral damage from,
sure,
from
and,
that.
And Larry recommended today that we claim eminent domain on the site.
And we said no. Yeah.
You said no, we can't?
No, I said no.
No, it's not.
We're
not entitled to.
No, we could, but we're not going to. Yeah, we're not going to.
Okay. So is that option like the cheapest option? Because then you can put in a vault. I mean, is there something we can do that's more expensive? It just involves more engineering, some sort of underground structure. Well, the one of the issues is that every time we move this thing, it costs more money, right? Yeah. I mean, it's fully designed. Like, we have a set of plans with it in that spot, and that those designs were done based on feedback from the HOA's property manager that said, "You're good to go. It's approved, go for it." We get the design done, Chris and I walk into an HOA meeting, and they're like, "Oh, essentially we changed our mind, we wanted to look at our easement agreements, and now that we reviewed that open space easement agreement, we're not going to allow it."
Well, there's a couple things. Okay, so call the HOA up and say, "You know, the fees we told you about, I hate to tell you this, but our costs have gone way up because you guys have been fighting."
That's the trade-off.
And, you know, so now your assessment per month is going to be $25 extra than over and above what we told you.
So we could move it. It'll cost additional money, and either we stick with the loan we have and we find a way to eliminate or decrease the scope of some of the other items, or you go back and we get a larger loan with the division and they pay a larger assessment. That assessment gets levied across all the customers in Community Water.
It feels a little bit like, you know, we're sort of at the end of the dog's tail and we keep getting whipsawed around, and maybe it's just time for Flea to jump off.
So just stay tuned for...
Right.
Okay.
I'm feeling a lot like Bob. I've kind of had enough. So that's where we're at.
Does that take us through 10?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 11, general manager comments.
Quick update on the property purchase, procedural, just so you know where we're at. Commitment of title assurance has been received. Seller's disclosures have been received. There was nothing noteworthy in those. The boundary survey that's required for the subdivision process has been requested. Our due diligence period ends on March 10th. We don't have any other items on that due diligence list that we feel that we need to do. At this point, it's just waiting for the survey, complete the subdivision plat, and then we can settle 15 days following the recordation of that plat. The quick update on the antennas, the internet service providers up in Red Hawk and the other subdivisions on what we call the North Ridge. Chris and I are essentially gathering some information from the county to truly understand what their code requirements are, and we're going to present a solution that we think is best for all parties, and if the service providers don't like it, we're just going to terminate the license agreements. Similarly, we've had enough of that. So we're going to do our best to get this figured out, and if it doesn't work, then we're done. The drought response plan update. Lisa and Doug and I went to an American Water Resources Association luncheon in January. The topic was drought response, drought contingency planning. Weaver Basin presented their draft plan. Those were some of the exhibits that I presented here a month ago. Salt Lake City Public Utilities is also working on an update to their plan. They're interesting because they have a number of retail customers, and we're interested to see their approach to dealing with restrictions in the retail environment and how they're dealing with the financial impacts of that. We've reached out to them. They promised us a draft copy of their plan. They've asked or offered to sit down with us and collaborate, and they have some interest of our new meters and things like that. So it could be a good relationship building exercise where we learn a lot from them. Our ultimate plan, I envision, has elements from both of these plans. Weaver Basin tells us what these restrictions might look like. The Salt Lake plan shows us how one of the larger utilities in the state is dealing with that from a retail perspective. Given the fact we're both in draft stages, my thoughts are we hang tight, we get a hold of those drafts, and we start to build not much more than an outline of sorts or a stick idea of what this plan might look like this year and work on it more intensely next year, given our statutory requirement to get a capital facilities plan done. That's the priority. Mike emailed a couple weeks ago with some notes that he had. Mike, do you want to elaborate on that at all? Do you want me to summarize them? Or?
You're doing great.
Mike had he presented a couple options. One was, and Mike's concern is that June 1st is when Weber Basin will drop the hammer on any restrictions. So there were a couple approaches. One was essentially to come up with a plan, come up with drought rates, right, and kind of institute it the way we've been talking about, have a plan to be able to do that this year. The second option was to go out and investigate some agricultural water rights to be able to mitigate the impact of reductions from Weber Basin, right?
Yeah.
That's basically it, right?
That's what kind of control our wells under that plan?
Yeah, 79% of our water are water right leases with Weber Basin.
Leased.
So any restriction we expect, and I ask them directly, is going to be system-wide.
When they say drought contingency, they all talking about like disaster contingency, like if there was a fire in the watershed or something of that nature? Or is this pretty much confined to just drought?
These reports are confined to drought.
It's kind of, I think there's maybe a stakeholder step too.
There is, yeah.
To talk to the county.
Yeah.
Talk to the other water users, yeah. What are you guys doing?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some feedback from the council on,
yep.
You know, do we want to, which path, how serious do we want to get about this? How do we decide if we want to, because there's big economic impacts of if we shut
yeah.
off.
Yeah. There's, well, I was going to say, you know, at the end of the day, does Weber Basin have, you know, the statutory authority, I'll call it, to just say, okay, you guys get 90% and you guys only get 50%. Is there any requirement that they be equitable, or is it just kind of the rule of the sovereign and they just do what they want to do?
There are rules. Weber Basin hasn't been great about necessarily applying the rules. But I mean, that's something we'd have to look into.
Could they be sued, Dave?
They could. But I mean, it's like, you know, they're the 800-pound gorilla in the region, and
they deliver 250,000 acre feet a year, and we're 6,000 of that.
Yeah.
But we have a big economic impact, mm-hmm. and there's going to be conflicting interests between the ag on the east side and the economics on the west, and it's...
I think that's the reason why, I mean, the best shot is to have some direct discussions with Weber Basin to make sure that this doesn't overly impact us, but...
And I think that they, you know, if you look at those reduction numbers that we presented last month, I mean, they are hitting ag first, M&I. They've never in their history cut M&I, to my understanding.
Right.
And they're trying to protect that, but I think that that day will come.
Well, I think our concern is the outdoor water.
The outdoor
water.
Yeah, exactly.
When they cut that, because there's a, yep. you know, if, yep. if the...
What's M&I, by the way?
Municipal and industrial.
You're culinary.
Residential indoor.
Yeah.
But the, like, there's a lot of landscaping that would, you know, you would tell people you can water once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And
at which point you might as well tell them not to water.
You might as well tell them to just light it on fire.
Yeah.
And,
well, I'm stockpiling my snow.
They're putting in a big pile.
You all are.
Okay, I think that's a good summary, and I think that priority wise, I get that.
And obviously, there's some risk, right, of not having a plan in place by the beginning of the summer,
and not knowing what kind of plan.
Yeah,
that's the issue. Right?
The only other tidbit I'll throw in here is I did look at the groundwater levels of every one of our well sources, and they're doing far better than I expected. Our Keeley Formation, which is where we pull the most of our water, it's rock solid. It is today what it was, you know, prior to last summer. The wells that did decline significantly in the East Canyon watershed, their recovery is really steep. By the spring, it's going to be recovered. So from a groundwater perspective, I don't think there's going to be... Last year is not going to impact this year, which I felt better about.
Yeah, that's good news.
River Pace could still...
They sure can.
They can still...
So you look at that and say, oh, okay, well then you need it.
And that's the point. They would let us not use that so that it would stay in the watershed
for
other uses. Okay.
If we were to decide that it's important enough that we need to have something in place by June 1st, we'd have to outsource it. We'd have to hire a consultant to help us.
Shoot, it's February.
What's that?
Because it's
February. Yeah.
Yeah.
The only other thing would be to file for an injunction to give us more time. There you go.
You got
it. Okay. I don't know if there's any other thoughts. That's where we're at.
Start filling bottles up now. This is the answer. Right?
Well, I've got a question on the property.
We do have a good reserve. Well, so let's say we took a hit on revenue because they cut water.
Yeah.
It's not like we're running, you know, super.
Right.
We've got some reserves we could put in play to help us. Get rates in to customers if we had to. Correct?
I think it's just that, we're telling people they can't water their lawn. So we kind of need to, and I'm not sure, if June 1st, maybe it'll happen. I've got quite a bit of snow out there. And
That's good. Option four is kind of pray for snow. But I think about it from our constituents' point of view.
Yeah.
What would they want? Would they?
They'd want us to be prepared.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things of preparation is going to be public relations.
Yeah.
Response to
stakeholders.
Be able to get on and explain to people what's going on.
What do they want to do?
And I feel like these task forces that we've seen Salt Lake engage in Weber Basin have included many, many water entities, engineers, consultants that are working on these drought plans, So I feel like we need to, if it's a task force or some kind of committee that we need to get involved with the water providers in this
locally,
but we just need to start.
The coal community.
Yeah.
Could we put like a moratorium on new connections?
You could.
We could.
It's within your authority to do that.
Well, if you can't serve the people you got, something we.
Right, but if somebody, let's just say that a property comes with, somebody that's paid, $17,000 for that right to the water, I I wasn't sure you could say no to that.
Well, you might not be able to.
No.
If you've got an emergency circumstance, yeah, you can. If you don't have an emergency circumstance, then you may have to serve those who have paid an impact fee.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't be, you basically, for everybody else, you'd say, well, we're not going to accept impact fees for now. And so nobody else outside of those.
One of the main challenges, and I spoke to this at a speaking event I had in January, is it's the volatility, right? It's 1 year you got
plenty,
and the next year you've got nothing, and it's the nature of where we live, and it's only going to get worse. And my message was that it's our responsibility to guide our customers on what's allowed within the envelope that we're dealing with. Quite simply.
How much risk do they want to take?
Yeah, I think, I don't necessarily think, as long as the communication is there, I think people understand what's going on. You know, I think if there was a restriction, you know, we'd be on the radio and letting people know that, look, you know, our ability to serve has been cut back. We need all of you to help us to stay within the water resources that we have. The issue then becomes a financial impact, right? I mean, that's the problem internally.
Mike was talking about it being an allocation among users issue too.
And that's what
you say, we're going to supply the hospital, but not something else.
That's what's all
okay. But when they say we're going to supply X and not Y,
Salt Lake City Public Utilities. One of the elements that was interesting is they're spending a lot of time looking at, for a given restriction, how does it reallocate for all the different user groups?
Yeah.
And they're, depending upon what those restrictions look like, they'll also be probably attendant changes to the water concurrency. So in terms of getting building permits from the county, there may be everybody is getting a haircut in terms of the number of water concurrency letters that could be given out.
What about landscaping restrictions for
exactly, some kind of tax.
So they're talking about that. They're talking about changes to the development code. The challenge there, I think Dave can help me to understand this. I think that would only affect future development and not current development, unless there was some kind of ordinance or something.
They could. I mean, a good example is a lighting ordinance in the Snyderville Basin. Whereas before it was encouraging night skies and stuff, right now before the county council is a provision that basically says you've got 7 years to have all your lighting in conformance with the night sky standards. And that applies not just to new development, that applies to everybody else too. And they give them a period of time, have an amortization period to do that. And you could, depending upon the severity of the circumstances with water, yeah, the county council could do that. And they could say, hey, you know, we're changing landscaping. It's now going to be xeriscaping, kind of like what they did in Arizona. And you've got...
You can go out and buy it. You can buy landscaping.
Yeah, and you've got X amount of time to do that. So I mean, that's
Scott. What's those are all the climate predictions for here? I think a lot of people are thinking that we're going to get shorter, but that means we'll have less snow. Are we going to have less water?
There's going to be less water in our reservoirs as a result of a more rain at the coming in the fall and in the spring, as opposed to that falling in snow, is my understanding. So we're still going to get some snow, but it's going to get warmer. There's going to be more rain events. The rain events you know, don't lead to the runoff into the storage that you get out of the snowpack.
But is that based on just temperature that we have right now and saying if we change the temperature, how is that moisture going to come to us? Or is this some understanding where there's going to be a fundamental change in the climate?
We were basically back through those the paleo records, the tree ring records, and that's kind of a large basis is to look at the frequency and the severity of these drought events. And then the climate change is sort of another layer mm-hmm. on top of there, another scenario.
But I guess what I'm asking is that do we have an understanding of what the experts are saying the climate will be here in 20 years and 40 years of their best predictions? I think everybody understands that there might not be ski resorts. Mm-hmm. But
that was in the paper.
I guess what I have the best understanding of, Tim, is more related to the effects on storage in the reservoirs, which affects us. And it's just really looking at Weber Basin's chart and saying, okay, they've done a lot of work to try to stir up this research and get these experts involved to put these records and these projections together. And as a result of the changes that are expected, the storage levels are going to be such that we're going to have these years where there's very little water storage and thus they're going to restrict the use.
They projected it out the next 30 years. Yeah, and they said we're going to have three really severe ones, mm-hmm. and I think six mild ones or something like that.
Yeah.
And so that's the reason for wondering if we should have a plan.
Yeah, and part of the struggle, I think, is that I'm not aware of anybody that has a very formal plan, which is why you've got folks like Weber Basin and Salt Lake City Public Utilities running out getting a ton of grant money and putting together these huge efforts to try to figure out what they're going to do to deal with this. The small water companies, you know, the fact that we're even talking about this is likely far ahead of most.
And the climate modeling for this part of the U.S. is not that good because we're on the, you know how you've got like physiographic provinces? You've got these meteorologic provinces within the North American plate, and essentially we're on the boundary of a couple of those. So the models that have been done to date have drastically different results over a long time period. So
yeah, none of the climate models have accurately predicted. Over the last 20 years, I saw a graph, and the amount of error in them was something you don't want to base your decisions on. I think that's the reason why Weber Basin is mostly looking at the cyclical nature, and you know they're using proxy data, obviously with tree rings, but I think they're trying to estimate what the cycle is, and as we go into another cycle, what it's going to look like, and they're starting to make decisions on that in terms of conservation. And there's another bill at the legislature going through this session that talks about these conservation plans and saying, you know, putting some time deadlines on them and when you have to have them done. So obviously, you know, between Weber Basin and Central Utah and a number of them, they've obviously been talking to their legislators about the fact that they see these cyclical things coming in and we're going to have to do something about them. We are the second driest state in the United States, so
still growing.
I will reach out to the other stakeholders. I'd imagine Park City is talking about it. Some of the others, I'm not so sure.
Where's storage in the equation? I mean, we talk about
it's all below us.
Cutting out landscaping and all this other. Is there any serious discussion about storage?
Brown battery?
Additional storage?
Yeah, or is it one of these things that no one's going to talk about it unless we have this crisis memo that comes out that says we got to do all the above. We got to do storage. We have to make sure that we have the aquifers where they need to be. We got to get some stuff from the Weber Basin.
Because I'm guessing you probably can't permit storage in less than 10 years.
I have not seen Weber Basin be as aggressive on the storage front. I don't know why that is. There are some good storage places along the Wasatch Front.
Some this real gravel, storage is in the snowpack, though.
Yeah.
And that's what...
But that, going that's away. Free.
Yeah, and that's what's... So you can't replace but that the size.
The other storage is the whole ASR concept, right? So aquifer storage and recovery, so you pump it into the ground. But some of these long-term climate models, they're showing they'll have less surface water because of the decreased snowpack and warmer temperatures on either side of the snow season. But you're also going to get more infiltration in the winter because you don't have frozen ground. So the aquifers are actually potentially the same or higher than they are at present. It's just your reservoirs will be lower, so you won't be able to use your aquifers as storage.
Yeah, so you're going to need to go out. They need to go out and actually develop storage, surface storage, but they don't seem to be in a hurry to do that. There are a number of significantly deep gravel pits that are near end of life that would store quite a bit, and you'd have to seal it, but Weber Basin doesn't seem to be interested in doing that. So
porphyry copper pits.
Okay, well,
there's a couple little things that we still got to talk about.
Okay, so what else do we need to talk about?
We asked the question about personal devices. I chatted with Chris today. We chatted with Dave before all of you arrived. There was concern that came from the Open Meetings Act or the training about emails, non-regional emails on your cell phones, and whether or not your cell phone could be sequestered through a grammar request and all your personal information could be downloaded off of it if that happened. And Dave says that that would not happen.
As long as you're using the Mountain Regional email for all of your official email, then, yeah, your devices are fine. But you got to use that email, because then any grandma request or even any litigation, we would just use the server that we have here.
What about texts or phone calls?
The problem with texts is texts are... Grandma doesn't really recognize texts. They think the texts go away. So I would say try to do your business by email and use your Mountain Regional email. And you should be fine.
So even if we have the Gmail app on our phone,
correct,
they couldn't ask for the phone.
Nope, not if you're just
they
using
pull it from the server.
That's right.
Okay.
So why did we switch to the laptops? I thought because that was why.
Well, we because like Chris brought this up. We had iPads before because I just brought up the iPad idea, and he said we went to the laptops because viewing. What was it? Viewing the
board packets. Nobody liked doing it on the iPad. It was too small.
So then we went to the computers. So in any event,
I forgot about the iPad.
If you're comfortable loading the email account on your phone, it would help us to communicate. I'll leave it at that. If for those that aren't using the computer on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's just like an extra computer. You know, I remember to charge it up like the week before our meeting.
Yeah, I recognize that it's not often going to pull it out and turn it on. So,
especially now that
so
I'm
so it's okay
to
load,
Melody. Yeah.
There was also some discussion about being able to edit and mark up things. I think Bob had brought that up early on, and that was another reason for going to the Chromebooks was because then you're not using your own personal computer for that stuff. It's staying, again, on the Google account that's Mountain Regional's account that is, again, you can have it. I have access to pull grammar requests, so I can do that.
Okay, that's good information. That's a good update.
The last point is we need to talk about the email that Tim, you started with when we first kicked this meeting off from the customer. I'm assuming it's from Rick Saunders.
Mm-hmm. And we're sure he's not related to High Saunders?
Yeah, we're sure.
But it only went to part of the board because I didn't get it.
I responded.
Bob didn't get it.
Did you?
What I told him was, thank you for contacting me with your concerns. Please allow me some time to research your concerns before I or General Manager Scott Morrison get back to you.
Yep.
Perfect.
So I'm happy to respond to him.
That was kind of where I was at. I think we ought to have.
Do you
one
have
response
email?
Back.
What's that?
Do you have the email?
No, I've seen it. Well, I have it now because Karen forwarded it to me.
I sent you mine too.
Yeah.
Maybe you should forward yours to him and then you can just reply to that. That was really well said the way you typed it out.
Didn't say anything.
Well, no, you said
it. That's right.
Scott's going to reply.
So, what do we want to tell him? We have our charter is to rescue these failing water companies, so that's taken a lot of debt on, right?
His debt question is, you know, quite simply that we've interconnected all these systems and we're in the process of trying to drive that down. One of the issues that Marty has heard from this gentleman for years, his water's been shut off a number of times because he doesn't pay his bill. So he doesn't agree with. Yeah. So he has taken issue, if you will, with our rates. He just doesn't pay his bill. We shut his water off, and then he gets stirred up, and then he writes these emails.
Marty, can you tell if the renters pay the bill, or does it come from?
Well, you know, in our rules and regs, the owners of the property are the responsible party, and we require them to get the bill. Because we have the ability to lien them on their property taxes, and we don't want, because the renter doesn't pay, that the owner gets this tax lien that they weren't aware of. And so this has been years ago, so we've been doing this for more than 20 years. And so what ends up happening is if the renters just have to go online and they Express Bill Pay will email them a bill, and then they can pay the bill, and then Rick Saunders gets it, a hard copy, to his house in Salt Lake. That's where the bills go, so he knows that his renters either paying or not paying. And this is how all of the renters within our district, this is how it works. And it works out slick. We never have problems like this. And Mr. Saunders has come to the board in the past. May I
please?
In 2008, he came to our board because we began shutting people off. So we began sending shutoff notices, and those were $25 at the time. Now they're $30. So our staff has to go together, see all the people that are over 4 months late, and so they are getting a shutoff notice for it, with this fee. And then they're asked within, usually 15, 20 days to pay the bill, or we'll shut their water off. It takes $100 to shut it off, $100 to turn it back on once they pay. And so we don't want them to do that. We want them to pay their bill. And so the board, he came to a board meeting, and the board said, great, we will take that $25 fee off, but you need to be current for a year. That didn't happen. So it just goes on. Like every year there's at least one shutoff or more than one. And I don't know if he just gets bad renters. I don't know how they decide to pay their bill.
Is it the same single piece of property? Or
yes.
Is he,
it's a piece of property in Summit Park. This gentleman was involved before Mountain Regional was born. And it's the same piece of property. He runs rental properties, and this is what he owns in Summit Park.
So
it just
that
happens over. Yeah.
So that's one.
Different
part of
renters.
It. What else did he ask about?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Know our
well, whether our rates were fair.
District sized up against other ones.
Yep.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
They're comparable. No, we're very comparable to the other water providers.
Yes,
we really are.
Yes, we're competitive with the other providers here. And I'll put that in. I'll respond.
Is there anything else?
That's it.
Anybody have anything else?
I found it interesting that he has circled my wagon and not contacted me directly. He's contacted our staff. He's contacted Tom Fisher. He's contacted some of you, but not all of you. Tom gave him my email address. He hasn't responded to me or hasn't sent me a single note. But I will reach out to him.
Well, he apparently doesn't vote in the district anyway. So.
Okay, we'll be adjourned at 8:28.
I do.
You're a hero.
Yeah, they'll have a little boss in her tomorrow.